I'm opening the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for Thursday, April 16th, 2009. Just a reminder that cell phones, Blackberries, PDAs, etc. can interfere with our sound equipment. So if you hear buzzing, it's probably one of us up here, but it could be one of you, so please turn those off. They do cause interference. I am going to take the bill slightly out of order than they appear on the agenda, just because there's somebody here on Senate Bill 929 who has another commitment. So I'm going to start with that bill and then take the bills in order. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 929 and ask Lori to please do a brief summary of where we are with Senate Bill 929.
I would be happy to, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 929 was amended by the committee on Tuesday, April 14th. With the Dash 1 amendments and the Dash 2 amendments. This bill requires manufactured dwelling park landlords to use submetering as a billing method when the landlord assesses the utility or service charge for water. The first amendment that you passed requires compliance by January 2nd, 2012. The second amendment, or the Dash 2 amendments, limit the application of the measure to manufactured dwelling parks with 200 or more spaces. You have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact statements before you.
Thank you, Lori. And if you recall, this is the bill where we had some testimony questioning the legality of the provisions of the bill, and I tried to clarify that myself, but not feeling totally comfortable feeling like I was giving legal advice, I did ask somebody who knows the issue to come and explain that briefly to the committee, and Brent Foster is here from the Department of Justice. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. We were asked to essentially look at whether or not the proposed bill, SB 929, would be inconsistent with the Safe Drinking Water Act or require that specifically mobile home parks be regulated as would another water provider under that act. And we don't believe that it would violate the Safe Drinking Act or require regulation of mobile home parks. And there's really there's a Fourth Circuit case, Manufactured Housing Institute v. U.S. EPA, where the mobile home industry, and this I think might be the source of some of the confusion anyway, asked to be essentially receive a wholesale exemption, say that EPA will say we are never, ever to be regulated as somebody who is essentially a water provider underneath the Act. And that did not succeed. And essentially what the court said and what is essentially the law that the committee would likely want to be aware of is it is really up to the case of the state on a case-by-case basis. The Act, the general intent of the Act is to exempt entities such as, and they refer to hotels, trailer parks, etc., where all that park is doing is distributing water that comes from an entity that's already regulated. If they took it from their own well, if they were processing it, if they were treating it themselves, then that is something that the Safe Drinking Water Act would want to regulate. If they're merely passing it on, if it consists only of distribution and storage facilities, if they are not selling the water, meaning they're not actually profiting from the water, and which they obtain all of their water from a public water system to which the regulations apply, then essentially the statute itself says that that entity is not subject to the Safe Drinking Water Act. EPA has had some differing regulations, but starting from the Act itself doesn't require it. The applicable case law simply says, broad class, we're not going to exempt everybody, but it doesn't say that if you do have submetering within a mobile home park, it necessarily is a regulated entity.
Thank you. Questions for Ben? Thank you. I have a question. Are you familiar with submetering and whether that furthers conservation of water?
I probably learned from the legislative history and the history of the case in which that was definitely an issue. And I think the court acknowledged that according to EPA and others, there was something on the order of, if I'm remembering right, and this is offhand, but 15% to 30% potential water conservations when essentially people had to pay for the water that they were using.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Right, committee, we already have adopted the dash one and the dash two, so I'll entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 929 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Girard moves Senate Bill 929 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Can we have a roll call vote, please, Bonnie?
Senator Burdick?
Excused.
Senator Girard?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Nope.
Aye. Senate Bill 929 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the chair will carry the bill. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 929 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 467. All right, can you please give us an update on 467?
I would be happy to, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 467 was before the committee for a hearing in March, March 12th. It prohibits the local government from applying approval criteria to single-family dwelling with five or fewer room or accommodations where that criteria is different from approval criteria applied to single-family dwellings with no room or accommodations. The measure defines approval criteria to include the zoning requirements, use permits, property tax classifications, building code specifications, fire life safety code specifications, occupancy or use restrictions, permit fees, license fees, system development charges, or similar conditions for siting, construction, occupancy, or use of dwelling or dwelling addition. Now, the dash ones that are before you, the dash one amendments, remove several things from that definition of approval criteria. Building code specifications, fire and life safety code specifications, and occupancy restrictions. And then another part of the dash ones remove the provision applying the measure to room or accommodations that simply are occupied before, on, or after the effective date of the measure.
Thank you. And committee, you may recall that we had Senator Atkinson here when we had a hearing on this bill before in March, and he's back if he wants to come up and discuss this bill. I did ask Senator Atkinson, and I know Senator George was interested in this, to see if they could work out something, and I'm interested in hearing back from you. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you very much. For the record, Jason Atkinson, State Senator. I represent District 2 in Southern Oregon. Madam Chair and members of the committee, a lot has transpired since the last time that you did hear this bill. And at the Chair's discretion, we did have or participated in the drafting of the dash ones, I believe, with the committee, and also some concerned parties in state government. If I recall correctly, forgive me if I have this wrong, but I believe building departments also had an interest in making sure that there was no unintended consequences. But let me just walk you through this bill. What we're trying to do on this bill is tighten up an ambiguity in the law that is being used, I believe, unfairly by a municipality for a landowner. But the larger issue, if you just take that example aside, the example that I'm involved with, if you take that aside, the larger policy before us is, should we have a policy, a statewide policy, regarding renting of rooms? That's really the issue. I think the opponents of a measure like this will say, well, Senator Atkinson, this is a local process. And I have to tell you, even preparing for today, I am thoroughly tired of this bill, but I will not stop. I have been at this silly issue with this city for over a year and a half. When it first came up, I went and visited the mayor, thought that we could just fix this, and I got nowhere. Then I went and spoke to the city council, and the city council was less than favorable. And they decided that they should go through their process, which I did on behalf of the constituent. I went to their local, and forgive me if I get this title wrong, but it's a housing commission. And they all agreed, this is wrong. And then they tried to fix it as in the committee process and made it even more cumbersome. Now there's even more questions to the law, which is where I believe we need the this legislation. I also attempted very much to work with the Oregon Department of Housing and got absolutely nowhere. I think I told you in the last time I spoke on this bill that their performance was less than good. The city will also tell you, well, Senator Atkinson, this requires a conditional use permit. And I will read in just a moment some of the things that reply to that, but if you apply the conditional use permit, here's what happens. Number one, it's onerous. Number two, there is absolutely no guarantee. And number three, it has the ability for somebody to be strong-handed, if they choose to be, towards an individual, which is what's happening in this case. I have a member, the constituent is a former member of a planning commission, and this is just stupid local politics grinding someone. But while that may be, I'm not asking you to involve yourself in that, the larger policy remains, can you rent a room? As was previously stated from Senator George the last time this bill came up, it was asked, do you need a conditional use permit to rent any rooms? And I believe the city made some thoughts that, well, maybe you do. And then the city would obviously say, well, how can we possibly enforce all of the rooms that are being rented, which I think makes the case altogether. We certainly have no restrictions like this in the city of Portland. We certainly have no restrictions like this in Sherwood. We certainly have no restrictions like this in Staten, and we certainly have no restrictions like this in any number of our chief college towns. The case, as it would come up for a conditional use permit, actually involves something that we, as policymakers, want to be very mindful of, and that is adult care facilities and foster homes and all of those, that whole type of housing, which is completely different from this. And you all have done casework, understanding the nuances of siting those and having those neighborhoods and all of those. And the reason we have a conditional use permit there is for increase, but it's also, in case of something going wrong, it is really the accountability effort to change behavior if that needs to have an enforcement action on that particular type of business. Now, let me get to the heart of the issue. The heart of the issue revolves around an archaic piece of language that is being implemented here to, in my words, these are only my words, but is to extract CUP charges out of an individual. And it hangs up around an archaic word used from the 1930s where we cannot seem to get a singular definition around the phrase lodging house or boarding house. Now, if you look at our law, it's actually fairly difficult to figure all this out. So what Senate Bill 467 seeks to do is to add, to tighten up a statewide policy as to what these things are. Under the current building code, the Oregon Structural Specialty Code, in effect in 2004, would state that a lodging house is any building or portion thereof containing not more than 5 guest rooms where rent is paid in money or labor or otherwise, is an Group R, Division 3, whatever that means, and built to the standards of a single-family dwelling. Now, when you get into all of the ways that go into this, the city of Medford actually looks at this particular person and applies, because they can, the hotel and motel calculations to figure fees from their public works departments. The hotel and motel calculations. Now, that is $9,500 plus consultants plus attorneys with no guarantee. And that's in $2,004. So we know that even if, as silly as that sounds, even if this person in this particular case wanted to do that, is going to be looking at $14,000 or $15,000 in today's money. The next part of this, and I'll be brief because I'm so tired of talking about it. I'm sure you're tired of listening to it. But the definition between boarding or lodging houses gets hung up around, does a single-family dwelling unit include the rooms or not include the rooms? That's part of the hang-up. So if you have a single-family dwelling unit and you take the word family and you do a Google search within the law, can you find what the definition of family is? Well, actually, as we all know, that definition is very hard to find. So it leaves ambiguity out for somebody to take CUP fees and apply hotel fees to somebody that they don't like. Now, if you have 2 bedrooms or more and a portion of that building does not exceed 5 guest rooms, do you have to have a motel-sized conditional use permit? I say no. And I think that all of the other citizens that you represent who want to do something in a limited fashion would also agree that that is sound policy. The city will say, well, maybe you can't enforce it. Well, if you're going to apply it to one, then you've got to enforce it to all. That's how it works. You can't pick and choose. Let me leave one other thing. With you, just for the record, lodging houses requires is an area with 3 to 5 guest rooms and requires the owner requires it to be owner occupied, even though a family daycare, which we all have in our districts, which has 16 or fewer children, and a residential care facility with 5 or fewer residents, are outright permitted in the exact same zones that we're going after here. So what's got the burr under my saddle, and while I will never let go until we fix this, is that we have one constituent being treated unfairly by a municipality because they can. And they're saying, Senator Atkins, just follow the local process. Well, I did. I didn't come here first. I went to the mayor first. So as you look at this, let me leave you with the state and cities have adopted a code that defines a lodging house. The same code further states that when a building or a portion thereof contains 5 or fewer individual rooms for rent, it shall be treated as a single-family dwelling. Collect room fees, if so imposed, but remove the stigma and legal and financial implications from a non-conforming use. Removing the requirement for a conditional use permit and the unreasonable conditions and fees imposed by such a process is the right thing to do. And I believe that the -1 amendments in the bill in its simplest form, Senate Bill 467, is the way to do that, and I believe it's the right thing to do. Madam Chair, I'd be delighted to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Atkinson? Senator Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, we have written testimony from the League of Oregon Cities expressing some concerns about the original bill. I don't see them in the room, but do you know, does this amendment take care of those concerns? They were specifically saying that they were worried that health and safety standards would be affected if this were to go through, and I think you deleted some of the language from the original bill. It looks like that dealt with fire and life safety codes.
Madam Chair, Senator, I have not spoken to the League of Oregon Cities. They have not visited me in my office. I believe that the -1 takes care of it, but I don't know. Okay. I believe it does, but best to ask them.
Okay, that's fair. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we do have somebody here who could possibly answer those questions.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick?
And maybe the other person will be able to answer it. But in Portland, apparently, and I didn't even know this until I got this information, but apparently single-room occupancy housing is not permitted at all in any single dwelling zone. So would this overturn that requirement and force people to have zoning where it's just flat-out not allowed now?
Say that question again. I'm sure you...
According to the information I have in front of me is that single-room occupancy housing is not permitted in any single dwelling zone, you know, where it's a residential area. It's just not permitted at all. Would this overturn that?
How is that possible?
Mm-hmm. Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, Senator Girard is shaking his head yes. I don't know the answer. I think it might. I'm trying to create a flat statewide policy that says that under these conditions you can rent a room. So I'm trying to make it permissive. I'm actually trying to make it permissive, so I don't know how it would start to regulate something when I'm trying to make it permissive.
Permissive to who, though? To the cities?
Permissive to the people renting the rooms.
Right.
Yeah.
So the city could not... So what you're saying is that the city would have to get rid of this ordinance that prohibits them altogether. There are other cities that have conditional uses, but this one is an outright prohibition in certain areas. So you're saying that that would preempt this?
I think so. And the reason is are people renting rooms in those dwellings now? in Portland? I would say they probably are. There's people that are renting rooms legally. They think they're doing it legally all over the state. In fact, most people who've worked their way through college have probably been in this very situation. And in a time when we have people who are running out of housing options, in this particular case, when this thing hit the newspaper, we had a couple of, I know there was one low-income veteran who had just got out of the domiciliary in Southern Oregon and was working his way up and was staying in one of these rooms. Under the strict interpretation of what the city's attorney wants to do, that person is thrown out. And I think that's wrong. So the permissive nature of it is saying that this can happen. And that's the push from my end.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the senator? Thank you so much, Senator. Pat Allen is here from DCBS. And then also, I think Angela from League of Cities, are you willing to come forward and answer the question? And also, we have three chairs, so I'll bring Cindy Robert up as well. Perhaps Angela, you can answer Senator Burdick's question when you come up. Welcome. Mr. Allen, you want to go first?
Sure, thanks. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, I'm Patrick Allen, Deputy Administrator at the Building Codes Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We set the construction standards for safety issues, other construction-related issues, plumbing, electrical, structural, earthquake, those kinds of things. The Dash 1 amendments, as a matter of policy, the question's been taken up in the Oregon adoption of a residential structural code to basically say that for five or fewer units, you don't need to construct these facilities to a different construction standard for fire purposes, structural, and those kinds of things. So as a matter of policy, we already have in code something that's consistent with this approach. The point of the Dash 1 amendments, I believe, was at least in part to then delete from the bill those parts that have already been answered as a matter of policy in the building code and not create the possibility of unintended conflicts or unintended outcomes where the bill says something somewhat different than what the policy already does. The Dash 1s didn't quite do it. There's a word or two amendment that would need to happen to fix that. I'm happy to go deal with that on the House side if the committee decides they want to recommend this bill and the Senate ultimately moves it. But in terms of the issue of safety regulations related to construction, in policy today we've already found that a residential standard for five or fewer units meets public safety requirements.
Thank you. Who wants to go next? Cindy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert and I represent the City of Medford. First of all, the definition that you were just described is the singular definition for building codes for construction, for fire and life safety. It is not a definition for zoning. There is no single zoning definition in our state, as you all know, because I did, in fact, provide you with the ordinances for your individual cities. I also informed Senator Atkinson that I had given you all your different ordinances and that they varied greatly. So the ordinances run the gamut, as you've seen. Beaverton allows this boarding houses, but with a CUP, and they define them as three or more rooms. Medford's two or more rooms right now. Milwaukee says no boarding houses of any size in most of its residential zones, but in one, it allows it with a conditional use permit. Newburgh doesn't restrict it at all. They say you can use your house as you want, but for every room you rent out, you have to have a parking space. Portland, as the senator pointed out, restricts single-room occupancy housing in single-dwelling zones. Sherwood allows it up to five rooms. Tiger permits group living with five or fewer residents, but they require you to have someone who is technically in charge of supervising, managing, or monitoring the unrelated people living in the house. Every city is different. One size does not fit all. Mr. Earle's issue is not an example of a problem. It's an example of how local city zoning works, that all local city zoning has some form of recourse, which in this case was the CUP, which they did, in fact, apply for, which they will, in fact, receive. And I'm a little bit surprised to hear about the possible SDC charges based on hotel costs. Well, my understanding is that the Planning Commission gives the permission, but it's the engineering department that does the SDCs, and they haven't calculated them yet because the planning department has been held up from giving the approval because Mr. Earl has not come to the committee. Senator Atkinson said this is about one constituent and he will not give it up. It is. It's about one constituent. This is about one constituent. Your city ordinances work well. You have not had complaints in your cities, and your cities all have different ordinances. And I, too, am very frustrated by the issue, so I apologize for my probably overheated passion.
Hi, Angela.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Angela Carey with the League of Oregon Cities. And the dash ones don't alleviate the League's concerns with this bill, so we still have concerns.
Senator George?
Angela, here's what we're trying to get at. We have, as a common practice across the state, people renting out rooms. I rented out room to my brother for years. So we have a common practice out there, and you have cities who have regulations on the books where their citizens are unknowingly violating the law. Then you have a conditional use permit process, which I've been through many times and I think is incredibly onerous and incredibly expensive to get through for the average person. So what you have is that we're trying to find out where the state policy is upon where it is appropriate for the cities to say we are going to put on the additional burden of a conditional use permit. And there has to be some kind of agreement statewide about where it is that the cities can then go to the landowner and say, or the property owner, the homeowner, and say, you've crossed some line. And just because, I mean, you have cities that say two rooms, but and then you cross over, but if it's not being evenly applied, then that's where the problem is. I mean, you see what I'm saying? And so there has to be some kind of consistent state policy. Does the League have any position on what that consistent policy should be? Because right now you have thousands of households that are violating the laws and the codes all over the state, potentially.
Madam Chair, Senator George, well, I don't know if I can really answer your question. We just really feel like it's on a case-by-case basis and city-by-city basis, especially, I mean, we have some cities where there's a lot of colleges in town and they're going to have a lot more rental units and things like that, and we really do feel like it should be up to the city to decide.
Angela, I told the story last time. I'm not sure you're here. I have a piece of property in Marion County where Marion County made me go through a conditional use permit for an application for a use that was an outright permitted use under the state law. No doubt about it. They were totally wrong in the law. But I didn't have the time to litigate that issue with them. So I complied with the conditional use permit. So after I went through what should have been a $30 fee, if it was an outright permitted use, I had a $2,500 fee, another $1,500 fee, and I complied with those. I got my permit. Then they came in as one of the conditions that I had to have an engineered driveway. When I got done with that engineered driveway, which should have been a $30 permit, I had to put $12,500 worth of piping and pavement in to comply with the conditional use permit. That was an outright permitted use in the state. The problem is that once we go to the conditional use permit process, I end up paying $15,000 for something that was really had no impact on anybody else because the local government had me between a rock and a hard spot. What we've got here is a practice that people are doing all over the state. Sometimes a person pops up above and catches the attention of the local jurisdiction, and the conditional use permit process can be used to punish a specific person or used to extract money from them. So it seems like to me that we should be able to agree statewide that there's some level of people being able to rent rooms between family members, friends, whatever, at some level, I don't know what that is, 5 or 4 or 3 or what that is, that we all agree that does not rise to the threshold where the cities can, in essence, whether it's arbitrary or not, apply conditional use permit processes because we can't define what a family is. You get what I'm saying? I mean, you're not talking about separate kitchens. You're talking about rooms in a house with one kitchen. I mean, is there anywhere we can go with the League on this?
Senator Bonamici, Senator George. Linda Ludwig is actually the lobbyist assigned to this, and she had to be in hearing room E. So she would probably be the better person to talk to about where we could kind of draw the line. But I do know that there is a fiscal to cities, too, because this would affect those to be passed about 50 cities, and they would have to change their ordinances. So there would be a fiscal right there.
Madam Chair, if I might answer Senator George just real briefly. Senator George, it sounds like you have a really good example yourself of conditional use permit being used unfairly. And if you look at this issue with Mr. Earle, perhaps it comes down for you, again, on the use of the conditional use permit, not so much on the definition of boarding house. It seems to me that it seems like the issue is bigger. It's conditional use. It's not just conditional use for boarding houses.
Madam Chair, if I could, the answer to that's yes, is that there once you pass over from an outright permitted use into the conditional use process, once you make that crossover, then in essence the property owner, the homeowner, whatever, really doesn't know that the conditional use process is whatever the conditions the local jurisdiction decides to put on you, and they have a great deal of latitude in that. Mm-hmm. So when you cross over that line, you're then subjected to subjective criteria. And there needs to be some level, especially when we're talking about low-income housing and those types of things, there needs to be some level where people can offer this type of housing without being worried that they could face a $9,000 or $10,000 conditional use permit process to allow low-income housing people to stay there, because you may never recoup it. There has to be a line someplace where we say this type of low-income housing is allowed without a conditional use permit, because otherwise what you could do, and I'm just putting this out, you could have people going, I mean, I'm just thinking about in some rural communities, you could have people doing this, put in an ordinance to go after certain demographics, certain racial groups, certain ethnic groups, all kinds of different things can be used, and where they can say, hey, we're just following our local process on conditional use permits. And I think there needs to be some kind of state policy here. And that's what I'm asking. There's got to be some place where we can come to an agreement on this.
Madam Chair, Senator George, I appreciate your attention to that, because you're right. There probably does need to be something for conditional use permits to make sure that they're applied fairly and they're understandable across the state. The second piece on that, though, as far as this particular issue on boarding houses, is that when the structure was built, it was the owner was told what it could be and signed as to what it could be. So it's not totally in the dark. It's not a decision that just came out of the blue. He knew when he signed the document this was single family only. However, my third point would be, I think that you bring up a good conversation about conditional use permits and about talking about them, and I think it's something that all the cities and all the rural areas, all the counties should be involved in, not a decision that should be made on a patchwork piece by piece boarding house versus driveways versus easements basis as a response to one problem in one city. I think that if we could find something now, if I could facilitate a bill that's gone somewhere one body or the other and help you find some way to deal with a conditional use permit, I would. That's valid.
I'm sure follow-up. My problem is, Cindy, is that I am worried. I had no idea that there was even a chance that local governments could regulate somebody renting out rooms. And I come from agriculture, so I see all kinds of people who are from certain demographics that rent rooms together. And if you could start regulating those people, I mean, they may be just three people in three rooms in a house, and it may be maybe totally normal. But because of the fact that they're unrelated, they could actually require a conditional use permit and possibly charge $3,000, $5,000, $7,000 to the property owner. This could have huge ramifications. If take the Medford case totally off the table, I'm talking about if cities started realizing that they could use this area of law to regulate who lived in their communities, this could be incredibly dangerous. And what I'm saying is there needs to be some state law so that's applied evenly. And I don't even care about the Medford case. I'm saying there needs to be some line that says four bedrooms. People can live in those. There's common kitchen. It's a single family house. And we're not going to tell you who you can or cannot live with. And it doesn't cross over into the conditional use permit process where we can, in essence, extort or take from the property owner. There's got to be some line.
Madam Chair, Senator George, the problem is you're talking about a line for different communities. Ashland and Portland are not the same. The neighborhood needs on the streets of Portland are different than in Newburgh. In Newburgh, there aren't even zoning requirements. Sherwood, you know, the parking requirements are the only ones there because they don't need them. They're agricultural-based. In Portland, in Milwaukee, those are different areas where they have different needs. They have different strains on their transportation, their sewage. These are local decisions, and when you speak, and I understand your feelings about local government making sure that things are fair, but these decisions are not made in a back room, sir. They are made out in public with public input. Newburgh citizens helped make these rules. Portland citizens helped make these rules. It's not just done and arbitrarily applied to them. The communities make them, and then the city has to enforce the ones that communities made.
Other questions? Senator Jarrett.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to kind of follow up on what Senator George was saying. First of all, the Medford case, I think, is rather messy. I'm not sure I would...
Diplomatically.
I think that's a nice way of putting it. However, I do think that it brought up the concerns that you can't rent a room. And I think, Senator George, anybody that's ever gone to college, anybody that's ever had relatives, and I venture to say that you could probably pick up the Oregonian and find rooms to let in Portland, where they obviously are supposedly illegal. So the conditional use permit, having sat on a city, the city has so much latitude to say no that there's no criteria. And the idea of a zone is if you meet the criteria, you get the permit. Because there are some cities that just absolutely want to say no to everything. Or they want to basically get as much money out of you as they can. And so then they hit you with SDC charges having to do with that. So I do see the problem. I'm not 100% sure that the bill is still... the solution, but I do think that we need to have some sort of law that you do have the right to rent a room or two rooms or three rooms or however many we want to set, and then it just seems to me like we should be able to come to some sort of agreement, you know, put a work group together and see if we could come, but we don't have a whole lot of time, but and I know Senator Atkinson is probably getting fed up with it, but the league, and having sat on a city, there are criteria for like single family dwellings, duplexes, fourplexes. There is kind of a set sort of codes that I think that this could be incorporated in, that you could rent out a room. One thing that I might put in as a factor is that you have to be a living owner. I mean, you have to be an owner that resides within the dwelling. That might be something that I would want to include, which doesn't go with the Earl's case. But to see if anybody has anything to say about that.
Madam Chair, Senator Jarrett, I just want to clarify that in Medford, you can rent two rooms before you become a boarding house. And it's actually one of the more restrictive cities. I will admit to that. The others were 3, 5, or no restrictions at all.
Thank you. And I saw Senator Atkinson jumping up back there. Did you want to have one more word? we'll give Senator Atkinson one more opportunity, and then we're going to need to move on to some other bills.
For the record, Senator Jason Atkinson, representing District 2. First of all, colleagues, none of you like to be ambushed. The League of Oregon Cities did not come talk to me beforehand. They did not express their concerns between the first time that this bill was heard until today. And as all of you might know, I consider that Bush League pathetic. So I'm sorry if you're going to have a lobbyist come up here and throw 1,000 red herrings without talking to the chief proponent of the bill. That's not how we do things here. Number two, the city of Medford still wants to make this a personal bill, and it's not. I have asked you not to be involved in the silly Medford case. The Medford case, in my estimation, is extortion. I would never do business with this city in the way it handles, even me trying to do this at the local level. Leave local politics aside. You cannot rent a room. That's the problem. There is no flat policy in the state of Oregon to rent a room. If you're going to say everyone is illegal, then let's just be honest and say everyone's doing it wrong. And then let's have the city, or perhaps the League of Oregon Cities, go and enforce it. Or if we want to be and set a statewide policy that allows people to rent rooms, let's set that policy. And that's exactly what this bill does.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Well, colleagues, I'm concerned. I had thought that an amendment would come back that would resolve some of the issues that were raised. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 467, and I hope that they can continue to work together and come up with a policy that will address some of the concerns that were raised. And Senator Burdick would like to vote on Senate Bill 929, so we need to... Suspend the rule. Can I
open another work session?
Get a motion to suspend the rules. Is that how we do this?
And reopen a work
reopen.
Session.
I think I'll reopen a work rule. Session on Senate Bill
929. I vote aye, Madam Chair.
And Senator Burdick votes aye.
It will not change the outcome.
And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 929. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 515. Laura, can you please give us a summary of where we are on 515?
I would be happy to, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 515 has been before you several times. If you recall, this measure deals with what is typically known as lemon laws. I'll just generalize from the measure as introduced and then reference the amendments. The measure as introduced extends the time period for the consumer to notify a manufacturer of a new vehicle that the vehicle doesn't conform to warranty. It has some specific calculations for reasonable allowance for use determinations. It removes the requirement that the manufacturer be given the opportunity to cure the defect. It allows the consumer to participate in an informal dispute process. Allows the award of attorney's fees and expert witness fees and cost of prevailing consumer, clarifies some of the refundable charges and procedure for return of aftermarket items. It defines collateral charges. It does declare emergency and is effective on passage. Then there are several amendments. The dash ones you've had referenced before make some technical revisions, clarify a variety of the calculations for reasonable allowance for use, nonconformity, specifies that the manufacturer agent or authorized dealer or manufacturer is given one attempt to conform the vehicle to warranty if the nonconformity is likely to cause death or serious bodily injury. It also changes the statute of limitations provision from 2 years to 1 year after 24,000 miles is reached or 2 years after delivery of the vehicle, whichever ends earlier. Then the dash sevens are new amendments before you. And this has to do with what was referenced by the chair in a prior hearing, the model recreational or modern motor home law, I think it's called. And legislative council used those provisions to then draft the dash 7 amendments. And let me briefly summarize those, Madam Chair, if I may. The dash 7s add provisions regulating that nonconformity of motor homes. It clarifies the definitions that are relevant to the motor home lemon law. It requires certain disclosures. It specifies some actions required in establishing the nonconformity. It delineates, when the replacement motorhome may be necessary if the nonconformity cannot be fixed. It clarifies the trade-in allowance that is particular to motorhomes. It specifies when the living facility component must be replaced. It specifies certain affirmative defenses. It identifies the parameters of the informal dispute resolution that is particular to the motorhome lemon law. It clarifies that a cause of action is not created by the provisions of that lemon law. It specifies that the consumer or manufacturer may not join the dealer as a party to any proceeding pursuant to the measure, and it prohibits the collection of damages, chargeback, or reimbursement from the dealer by the manufacturer in proceedings pursuant to that measure, and then finally requires the disclosure of the nonconformity in the sale, lease, or transfer of the motorhome.
Thank you, Lori. And I'll tell you what I'd like to do with this committee. We did have a testimony on the Dash 1 amendments previously. We had some Dash 2 amendments, which I do not intend to move forward. What I'd like to do is adopt the Dash 1 amendments, and then I'm actually going to close the work session and open up a public hearing on the Dash 7 amendments because we haven't had consideration of these previously.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 515 dated March 31st.
Senator George moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 515. Any discussion? Should we do a roll call vote, Senator Gerard? Do you want a roll call vote?
I agree with the Dash 1 amendments.
Any objection? The Dash 1 amendments are adopted. And then I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 515 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 515. We haven't had testimony on the Dash 7 amendments yet. And because this is a significant change from what we've had before, I would like somebody to come up. And we have Enoch, and I'm sorry I forgot your last name. You can introduce yourself.
Hutchcraft, thank you, and John Brenneman, to come up and talk about the Dash 7 amendments. And committee members, this is something that we just recently received, some significant changes, but I believe it definitely worthy of our consideration. So we'll hear a little bit about the Dash 7 amendments and then take some questions.
Madam Chair, I'll start. My name is John Brenneman. I represent Recreational Vehicle Industries Association and have so for 10 or 12 years at least. And that's RVIA. It's a national trade association of manufacturers of recreational vehicles. With me is Enoch Hutchcraft, and Enoch works for Monaco. He has for years been working on model legislation for lemon law as it relates to motorhomes. And nationwide, it still has not been finally adopted, but we thought this would be a good opportunity to bring the working model forward and equal address yet what we see as a few problems. We would like to keep working on it and, with adoption of it, support the bill.
Madam Chair, thank you, John. My name is Enoch Hutchcraft, and I work for Monaco Coach Corp. I don't hold myself out as a lobbyist. I'm a business guy. I understand the nuts and bolts of motorhomes, and I understand the motorhome consumer. It's a very unique product. It's a unique consumer and a unique consumer product that is deserving of its own lemon law. We have a very discriminating consumer and a complex product that passes through hands where you have a chassis that you start with, which is basically a truck chassis. Then you put a box on it that's akin to a house. You add a generator that's like supplying the city power. You put a water system in it that's akin to the city water system. You put a sewer system in it that's akin to the city water, to the city sewer system. Then you make it all go down the road at 70 miles an hour. Or slower, we hope. Like Texas allows. We believe that, and to take one step back, about 14 years ago, Florida, as the number one RV motorhome state in the union, faced the same questions that we're looking at today and in this bill. And Florida invited the RV industry, consumer groups, their own state regulators to propose to have a long work session. We went there 1 week each month for 3 months. It was legislature was out, so we just went there and worked and worked and worked and came up with a bill that was reasonable for Florida, a model law that was reasonable for Florida. That was implemented. It was refined a bit. Some changes were made. And about 3 years ago, from that initial nugget of folks getting together, a group formed that was called IALA, which is an International Association of Lemon Law Administrators. I happen to bring the sheet from the 2008 meeting, and there's hundreds of people that actually get together at these conventions from Maine to Hawaii. There's a Japanese representative representing Japanese consumers. We do export on rare occasion to Japan, more to Australia, and more to Europe. But nonetheless, many, many states represented, Ohio, and there's a patchwork quilt, much like the earlier bill we were discussing that you were all were listening to, I was listening to, where there's a patchwork quilt of laws. So a model law was created. We invited all the stakeholders, multiple consumer groups, 1.5 million members of Good Sam Club, 500,000 members of Family Motor Coach Association, other smaller RV groups that numbered anywhere from 10 to 100 members that formed their own little club that wanted to talk about the legislation. So we've done that for 3 years. We had multiple, I've got thousands of hours in this model. And Oregon would be the first state to take this model and conform it to the state legislative agenda or package. So it would be very helpful for Oregon jobs. It's fair to Oregon consumers. It's well vetted, as it were, from the consumer groups. We have strong support from IALA, strong support from these various consumer groups. So we believe that we've come up with a fair law, and it's just now a matter of working it through the Oregon legislative process.
Any questions? I have a couple of questions. It's my understanding that this came to our legislative council from somebody from your group who had done sort of the initial drafting, and our legislative council had to make some changes to make it conform to Oregon statutory standards, but also it's my understanding that at least one portion of it had to be changed because it has an informal dispute resolution, and that was done through a state agency in the Model Act. And because of our budgetary considerations, the state agency involvement in the voluntary dispute resolution, alternative dispute resolution process, with the state agency piece was taken out. When we spoke about doing this, you mentioned that your organization didn't want any changes, and so do you believe that there's room for us to work on making this acceptable to the group, because there were some changes that we had to make it conform, and then there were others like taking the state agency out of the dispute resolution process that we thought we needed to make in order to eliminate a big price tag on the bill?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the short answer is yes. Frankly, I was arguing the consumer's position, saying that we really needed, the consumer groups want the power of the state behind the statute, that there is mandatory mediation and mandatory arbitration, and they wanted the power of the state to dictate to a manufacturer that they had to conform, they had to perform, they had to do what the statute said. There are other fair arbiters, DeMar & Associates, Better Business Bureau, AAA. There are a number of other arbiters that can render the same fair outcome, and I think we can work that out with the consumer groups.
Thank you. Questions? Anybody have any questions? I know, committee, that you haven't really had an opportunity to read through this. It's fairly new and fairly lengthy. A couple of the things that I worked on with legislative council was making sure that we sort of had the titles clear, that the part of the Lemon Law applying to cars would be the Motor Vehicle Lemon Law, and this would be called the Motor Home Lemon Law. We went back and forth on recreational vehicle, motor home. There are several definitions in our existing statute about what a motor vehicle is, and we tried to use as clear definitions as we could and put those titles on to distinguish those two sections. It does make a significant change in the dispute resolution process. It doesn't involve a court process unless the arbitration is challenged and taken to court. So that's one of the significant changes. And what I'd like to do is have the committee look at this. I know that we did get some input from Mr. Kirby, who's been working with legislative counsel. Tomorrow is the last day to really request amendments. This is back on the agenda for next week. So if we can fix some of the concerns here, we can talk about that. Alternatively, we may be able to work with the House Committee. If the committee is inclined to adopt this amendment, we can work with the House if there's some changes that need to be made over there if we run out of time. All right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gerard?
Are we not going to move amendments, the dash twos? Because the dash twos are, for me, are no go.
But we are not moving the dash twos.
All right.
Any other questions? All right, thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 515, and that is back up. Lori, do you remember? Is it back up on Tuesday?
I believe it's up on the 21st.
I believe it's up on Tuesday. So hopefully we'll have some more information then about whether we can work out some of the concerns.
Yes.
Finally, I will... I need to get my script on.
377.
There's one. Oh, yes. So, can I open a work session?
Yeah, and a possible reconsideration.
A work session and possible reconsideration on Senate Bill 377.
Madam Chair?
Senator Rosenbaum.
I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 377.
Senator Rosenbaum moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 377. The motion is not debatable. Is there any objection to the motion? No objection? The rules are suspended.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 377 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Senator Rosenbaum moves to reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 377 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion? If not, the motion carries and the measure is once again before the committee.
And Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which the Dash 5 amendments dated 4609 were adopted.
Senator Rosenbaum moves to reconsider the vote by which the committee adopted the Dash 5 amendments dated 4609. Is there any discussion? I'll add something here, and mea culpa, or as this generation says, my bad. The amendment that came back was not drafted as we expected, and I thought it was, and so we, once I realized that, I decided to pull this back so that we could get an amendment that was properly drafted, and a couple of other issues came up, and my staff has been working with several interested parties, and what we have before us now is something new. So that we have checked and carefully. So seeing none, if there's no objection to the motion carries, and the measure is once again before the committee in its original form.
So, Matt, I actually have a question for Lori. So, we, having reconsidered the vote, doesn't that just put the measure in front of us again?
Yeah.
Don't we still have to recede from that amendment, though?
We just did.
We did
yeah.
that.
Is that
we
what
did.
We did?
Yeah.
We just did. That's why we had to go through, you had to go through that
we
extra
just,
step.
We just
so now
we're
all
did.
The way
yeah,
back.
Yeah, right.
Okay,
so
we're back where we started.
All the way back.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah,
back
see.
To March or wherever the first
okay. So, Madam Chair,
So at the bottom of the
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 6 amendments dated 4-15-09.
Senator Rosenbaum moves to adopt the Dash 6 amendments dated 4-15-09. Is there any discussion? Any discussion? I just point out that we added some clarifying language in lines 16 and 17 and some clarifying language to make clear that if the consumer is asking for a particular line, then that line is re-rated and they need to make a separate request for each particular line.
Let's clarify.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I liked the bill before, and I like it even more now.
Thank you, Senator.
And that's my discussion.
Seeing that, is there any objection to the motion? If not, the motion carries and the amendments are adopted. I'm sorry, did you want to say?
No.
Oh, okay.
Another chance.
Yep, we're not done yet.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 377 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Rosenbaum moves Senate Bill 377 as amended again to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, Ann, or oh, it's not Ann. Bonnie, will you please call
yes.
the roll?
Reading my script.
Senator Rick?
All right.
Senator Gerard?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
No.
Aye. Senate Bill 377 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the chair will still carry the bill. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 377. And we did everything
yeah.
today. Any
yeah.
other business?
Yeah.
We are adjourned for today.